How is it that Roman Catholic politicians are so often pro-choice? Now, they're elected, and one might wonder how they get elected to be representatives and senators when they're pro-choice. They're avowedly Catholic, and yet they run counter to their church's teaching on the life issue. More puzzling still is how the same Roman Catholic pro-choice politicians end up being appointed to positions of influence within the church. Commissions, committees, how does it happen? Should it happen? We'll talk about that in the first half hour of Issues Etc. today. Deal Hudson joins us in just a moment from Crisis Magazine to discuss a recent meeting between pro-life leaders and Catholic bishops on that very issue. Open lines follows for an hour from 3:30 to 4:30. We'll be talking about a number of things, including, well, it's the latest fad to sweep the church, the latest silver bullet to be put into the chamber as the church prepares to take aim at dwindling numbers and the loss of enthusiasm. It's called 40 Days of Purpose. Rick Warren of Saddleback Church in Lake Forest, California, is the architect of 40 Days of Purpose. His book, Selling Like Hotcakes, influencing congregations across the nation and the world, for that matter, across denominational lines. We'll find out what it's all about. The LA Times has a rather extensive story on Warren and 40 Days of Purpose. I'll share that with you during Open Lines, along with some other news. For instance, Kenneth Hagin, granddaddy of the Word Faith movement. Name it, claim it, positive confession, confess your sickness away, that kind of thing. He collapsed in his home last Sunday. He's been in the hospital in critical condition. That's during Open Lines. Then, in the second hour, middle of the second hour, Laura Echevarria of National Right to Life joins us. You may have heard about this, the recent death of a California woman. She was pregnant, did not tell her parents, took RU486, the abortion pill, and she died. We'll talk with Laura Echevarria about that in the second hour of the program. In the third hour, three guests will be talking about the new Luther movie that opens in, well, at the end of this week. Pastor Paul McCain of Concordia Publishing House joins us. Then we'll be talking with Brian Gadawa, he's a Hollywood screenwriter, about war movies. How has the depiction of war in popular film changed over time? And then we'll get an update on the euthanasia case in Florida. Wesley Smith of the Discovery Institute joins us to talk about the woman whose husband wants her to die. He'll give us the latest update and the legal strategies of those who are trying to keep this woman alive. That's the lineup for Issues Etc. today. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Deal Hudson is publisher and editor of Crisis Magazine. He joins us from Washington. Deal, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Todd, it's good to be on your show.
Tell us about this recent meeting between pro-life leaders and Roman Catholic bishops.
Well, it was an important meeting because in July, for some reason, the leaders of the bishops' conference in the United States, including Bishop Gregory, members of the executive committee, had a kind of a secret meeting with... You wouldn't describe them all certainly as pro-choice Catholics or pro-abortion Catholics, but they were left-wing Catholics, many of whom hold dissenting opinions on important issues. And the group that Russ Shaw and I pulled together on September 8th to meet with the same bishops were certainly all uniform in behind the Catholic Church's teaching on the defense of life. And we said very clearly, we don't want you, the bishops, giving any honors or any responsibilities to pro-abortion Catholic leaders anymore. It's got to stop. It needs to come to an end. Because this is confusing Catholics in the pews about what is really important to the church. And as long as you do that, you're weakening your own leadership, and you're making it very difficult for other Catholic apostolates to make you look good. So that was the message we sent them.
They responded how?
Well, I would say that the response was good. I mean, they weren't leaping with joy at being criticized, but they understood exactly why we were meeting with them, exactly why we were bringing this issue to the fore, and they agree. You know, and they agreed that, you know, that there had been a certain level of confusion sowed by the bishops in the past when they asked people like Senator Ted Kennedy or Senator Tom Daschle to receive awards, chair Catholic dinners, and even just call themselves Catholic in the public square.
Of the bishops, who was present at this recent meetings?
Bishop Wilton Gregory, Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, Bishops Lynch of St. Petersburg, Bishop Skillstead of Spokane, and Bishop Friend of Shreveport.
And specifically, what did Bishop Wilton Gregory, who is president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, have to say in this meeting?
I can't tell you. The rules of the meeting were that we would only speak... we would only report on what we said and on our general impressions of the meeting. We promised that we would not specifically quote other comments from other people.
And who were the pro-life leaders that were present there, Deal?
The Catholic leaders who were there included Bill Donahue of the Catholic League, Tim O'Donnell, the president of Christendom College, President Tom Dillon of Thomas Aquinas College in Ojai, California, Robert Novak of Crossfire and the Capital Gang, Kate O'Byrne of National Review, Congressman Michael Ferguson from Northern New Jersey, Lieutenant Governor Michael Steele of the state of Maryland. We had a lot of heavy hitters in the room.
How extensive is the problem that you're trying to address with the bishops at this point? Can you give us some examples of the inconsistencies that are being exhibited when prominent Roman Catholics are given positions of influence and yet they hold dissenting opinions from their church on life and other issues?
Well, every time the Senate has a vote on a life issue, there's confusion. I mean, every time the Senate Judiciary Committee, led by, or at least the Democratic side, led by Patrick Leahy or whatever, whenever they turn down a Catholic or a pro-life candidate on the grounds of some kind of vague, extreme commitment to religious ideas or some on inability to separate their personal feelings from their, from their judgment in legal matters, it is very clear that a lot of Catholics leaders in the political world are getting a free pass on their dissenting positions vis-a-vis the teaching of the Catholic Church.
I know you can't go into specifics, but did the role of the presidential candidates come up in this meeting at which time, you know, we've had several of them who have said, look, I'm a Roman Catholic and I'd like your vote, but of course I'm only going to appoint pro-choice judges, things like that.
Yeah, well, you're talking about Kerry and Clark.
Mm-hmm.
No, it didn't come up.
All right. Then
guys become serious players in the Democratic nomination process, you're darn right it's going to come up.
What should the bishops do? The example that I was thinking of several days ago was Senator Tom Daschle, South Dakota, Roman Catholic, a bishop in his home bishopric. They had a little scuffle in the press. And apparently the bishop was unhappy with Daschle referring to himself as a Roman Catholic. Is this another example of what you're talking about?
Yeah. I mean, actually now both of the bishops in South Dakota have taken Daschle to task for his calling himself a Catholic at the same time, you know, raising money for Planned Parenthood and, you know, being basically one of the leaders of the culture of death in the Senate. So, I mean, that's a very good example of what's going on.
We're talking with Deal Hudson, publisher and editor of Crisis Magazine. He joins us from Washington about a recent meeting between pro-life leaders and Catholic bishops. Tell us about the controversy surrounding the recent appointment of Leon Panetta to a high-profile Roman Catholic commission.
It's not really a recent controversy. I mean, ever since he was named to be a member of the National Review Board, I mean, here's the guy who really was the point man for President Clinton's vetoing of the partial birth abortion ban two times. And ever since he was appointed, there's been a constant stream of criticism about that appointment. And I would say it only just came to a head with the meeting we had on September 8th, where the message was very clear that this is not the kind of leadership that we expect from the bishops, to put somebody like this in a position of responsibility that requires a real commitment to the teaching of the Catholic Church.
So what is the National Review Board to which Leon Panetta was appointed?
The National Review Board was created in order by the bishops in order to have some oversight, some lay oversight in the sexual abuse crisis and the response of the bishops to that crisis. And so they were charged with implementing or overseeing the implementation of the policies adopted by the bishops in their Dallas meeting just after the crisis broke.
Now, back to the question, what do you think the bishops should be doing? Let's take that concrete example again. You've got Tom Daschle. He is legislating and voting for pro-choice legislation. He is adamant about this. He really more or less thumbs his nose at the bishop who calls him on the carpet about this. What should that bishop do?
Well, I mean, they should do exactly what his bishops in South Dakota did. I mean, first they should contact him privately and say that unless he begins to reflect more clearly the teaching of the church, that they're going to have to say something publicly. If nothing happens on the, you know, behind the scenes, then at some point Bishop has to say to the members of his archdiocese or diocese that I want you to know that although your elected representative refers to himself or describes himself as a Catholic, in my opinion, as your bishop, that's not accurate, because this person is, for example, promoting abortion on demand or gay marriage, for that matter.
What is the practice of church discipline in the Roman Catholic Church? Should these pro-choice politicians be subjects of such discipline if, as you say, no other preliminary or private conversations are fruitful?
In general, they should be. And in general, there should be some kind of at least correcting of the record when the politicians speak this way. And we're getting more and more bishops involved in correcting that record, which is good. But we need to see, we need Catholics, basically, Catholic politicians, put on notice that they're going to, you know, they can either stop calling themselves Catholic or be put on notice that their bishop is going to correct the record when they act in a way that is out of sync with the accepted teachings of the church.
Why do you think so many bishops are silent and do not speak out against pro-choice politicians?
I think some of them are afraid of backlash. Some of them are afraid that it's actually maybe even helping politicians get elected when they do that. Some are worried that it might play into the hands of the Republican Party because some people, you know, some bishops are undoubtedly, so opposed to the Republican Party and so committed to the Democratic Party that they actually, are worried about such actions helping the Republican relationship with Catholics. There's all kind of issues involved. Some are afraid of alienating, pro-choice donors in their diocese, philanthropists.
Well, I guess that raises a question about the degree to which pro-choice politicians, Roman Catholic politicians, represent the rank and file of Roman Catholics. What percentage of Roman Catholic laity would you say are pro-choice?
When you talk about Roman Catholic laity, you have to distinguish between Catholics who attend Mass and Catholics who do not.
Mm-hmm.
And even among all Catholics, including those who don't attend Mass, the majority are pro-life, as are the majority of Americans, Todd. Of the percentage who are pro-life among the entire spectrum of Mass-attending Catholics, it's more up in the 60 and 70%.
Does this gap between what the bishops are saying and what the Church teaches and what the most visible Roman Catholics in American culture are saying and promoting, does this gap represent a moral crisis for the bishops, for the hierarchy, the authority of the Church in the United States?
Oh, absolutely it does. It's one of the biggest crises the Church in this country has ever faced. And we've lost a lot of credibility. We've lost a lot of moral authority. It's going to take a long time to get it back. And I think the only way you're going to get it back is by doing what hasn't been done in the past, and that is speaking the truth with charity and letting the chips fall where they may.
Have there been any statements from the Vatican addressing this problem, this gap that we're discussing?
Oh, yeah. The Vatican's been loud and clear over the 25 years of John Paul II's pontificate about the importance of upholding moral truth in the political sphere. I mean, and actually, from a document point of view, the American bishops have been very clear about it. But I think the Vatican has been, a little more consistent than the American bishops have been.
Do younger bishops tend to be more conservative and more in line with not only enforcing but being vocal about the Church's teaching when they run into conflicts like this?
Oh, yeah. The younger bishops, and by that I mean 60 and under, are, because bishops don't tend to become bishops until very early, at the earliest in their mid-50s, and because they retire, I think they would start retiring at 75, and they got to be out by 80, I think. They are more conservative, which is good, and I think that it's very important to realize that the bishops who are coming into their own now are going to be a whole different breed from what we've seen over the last 20 years.
What do you think? Is this, I'm trying to look at this broadly and generally, and seeing this as a trend not only in the Roman Catholic Church, I mean, that's a great example, but also across Christendom in America, and I wonder whether or not this gap that we're discussing is only symptomatic of really an American ethos, an American way of thinking about things, maybe even a baby boomer phenomenon, that these politicians say, look, authority, authority of the Church, authority of this, authority of that, we're a new breed. We're a new breed of Roman Catholics who take from our Church what we think is good, but the Church's authority, we're not so willing to respect that. What do you think?
Well, Todd, I mean, that's been a perennial problem in the Catholic Church throughout history. You see it in the first century of the Catholic Church in America. There was an outbreak of this kind of thing in Philadelphia in the early 1700s. There's always a tension between a commitment to culture, commitment to politics, and a commitment to the truths of as revealed by God and Jesus Christ. So this is just another you know, go round of the same old thing. And so call it baby boomer, call it Gen X, call it whatever you want. It's just good old original sin, you know, showing its head again.
Somewhat off the subject, but could you tell us what you know about the current health of Pope John Paul II? The news has been that his frailty seems to be increasing. And would you speak briefly to the issue of the next pope?
Next pope's in the hands of the Holy Spirit, so I'm not worrying about that at all. You know, a lot of liberals out there are hoping for somebody very much unlike John Paul II, but, you know, it's just not going to happen that way. Every time somebody tries to make a big deal about over the pope's health, pope gets better. The last person who made publicly a big, you know, big stink over the pope's health actually died before he's been dead 10 years, and John Paul II's been alive. So, you know, Parkinson's, as we all know, is a tough disease, and it takes you down slowly. That's what's happening to him, and, you know, he will vacate his office at a time when he and his staff know that he can no longer do the job.
What do you have to say to groups like Catholics for Free Choice, pro-choice Catholic organizations?
I tell them to stop lying to the public about who you represent. I want you to go away. I want you as an organization to stop existing because of the damage you're doing to life, and especially the fact that you're basically making the word Catholic something that it doesn't mean, and exactly the opposite meaning.
Finally, are there any follow-up meetings or actions planned between the pro-life leaders and the bishops from this recent meeting?
Yeah, there are some things that are in the tunnel, and I would say that we'll just have to see what comes out the other side. Let's pray for the best.
Neil Hudson, keep up the good work, and thank you very much for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
Okay, thanks, Todd.
Neil Hudson is publisher and editor of Crisis Magazine. He joined us from Washington talking about this recent meeting between pro-life leaders and Catholic bishops. You can read the article we made reference to in Crisis Magazine at their website, crisismagazine.com, crisismagazine.com. When we come back from this break, I'm looking at the news as it unfolds before us. First of all, Kenneth Hagin Sr. in the hospital. He is the granddaddy of the Word Faith movement. I'll explain that a little bit when Open Lines winds up here after this break. Also, Jim Baker, a settlement has been reached. Remember how he was put into jail for, what, did he get a 48-year sentence for wire fraud and defrauding a bunch of people? 165,000 people, to be exact. The settlement has been issued. The lawyers have taken their cut, and you'll be surprised to hear how much each of the plaintiffs will be receiving in that settlement against that class action suit against Jim Baker. And in the meantime, he's down in Branson. He has a new wife, and he started up another television program, Jim Baker, yes. And we'll talk about Rick Warren's purpose-driven life when we come back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
What is Christian freedom? What does St. Paul mean when he writes to the Colossian Christians, "Whatever you do in word or deed, do it all in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ"? What does it mean to do something in the name of Jesus? You'll find answers to these questions and more in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, the Concordia Commentary on Colossians by Dr. Paul Dieterding. You can order the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Colossians online. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and you'll find information on the book. Or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September is the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Colossians.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on the African country of Congo. Even though you'll hear about death, please pray for Christ's life to sustain people. More than 3 million people have died in Congo during the past few years from an ethnic war and the resulting malnutrition and no access to medical care. A missionary family witnessed the destruction of a medical hospital and the Mission Aviation Fellowship Air Base. But there's a sign of hope. Missionaries Garth and Jody Pedersen with MAF described a humble Congolese man named Prosper, who started an orphanage. He has 80 children in his care who were beaten during battle or they watched their parents die. Many of the children have accepted Christ. They study the Bible and sing praise songs daily. Pray that these children will grow in their faith and be examples of Christ's love. Get prayer information on countries by logging on to the website missionvisionnetwork.org. Get prayer guidelines too. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Chris Sayer of Greenwood, South Carolina said, "I'm a Christian, and it's against God's word for two people of the same sex to be married." Most Americans are opposed to gay marriage, and many, like Mr. Sayer, for biblical reasons. But believers often throw up their hands in despair because the separation of church and state forbids biblical arguments in the public square. No problem. Rational reasons abound for staying with traditional morality. Should the state go against millennia of history? Should the state go against common sense? Should the state presume to redefine a public institution, marriage? Well, then no family life will be safe. Let the government redefine marriage, and you have given it precedent to dictate much more about how you and your family must live. A federal marriage amendment to the Constitution has been introduced in Congress. It defines marriage as between a man and a woman. Find out about it. Talk it up. The possibility of gay marriage is like an Isabel, threatening havoc to our most basic institution. Unlike Isabel, we can avert this destruction. Thanks for listening. Thanks for thinking. I'm Dale Meyer.
An exhibition titled Seasons by master photographer Jack Jennings is now open at the Missouri Botanical Garden, and his new book of garden photos is also available. The exhibition continues through November 14th at the Gardens Ridgeway Center, 4344 Shaw Boulevard, and is included with admission or membership. For 25 years, Jennings has captured the Botanical Garden's natural beauty year-round, and it's all on display in the exhibition Seasons at the Missouri Botanical Garden.
Welcome back. Before we get into this hour of open lines, I'd like to invite you to attend a private screening of a new movie. We'll be talking about it later in the program with Paul McCain in the third hour. It's the Luther movie. It debuts this coming Friday. We're going to have a special showing, special screening at 10 a.m. on Saturday morning, September the 27th at the DePere 14 Cinema. That's located at 12701 Manchester Road. You will see it if you come to the confluence of 270 and Manchester. It's right there on the West County side of 270. 12701 Manchester Road, 10 a.m. Saturday morning, September the 27th, a private screening for AM 850 KFUO viewers. The cost is $10. Now, that includes admission to the movie, soda, and popcorn. We will be there leading a discussion. I will, before and after the film. Seating is limited. You can reserve a spot by calling 1-800-844-0524. 1-800-844-0524. Someone is there to answer the phone right now. Johnny will answer 1-800-844-0524. Or you can call our automated resource line, 1-800-737-0172. Have your MasterCard, your Visa, or your Discover card when you call. I hope to see you this Saturday, September the 27th, 10 a.m., the DePere 14 for a private screening for AM 850 KFUO listeners of the new Luther movie. Discussion before, discussion after, $10 per person. It's open lines, issues, etc. For the next hour, we're going to be talking a little bit about the purpose-driven life, but before we get there, here's a few things just leading up to it. It seems as though the church, maybe this is just a perennial problem. in American Christendom. Maybe it is the a strange connection between what we witness in the church, and I'm going to talk a bit about a fad-driven church. Maybe there's a connection between a fad-driven church speaking generally about Christendom in America and the nature of the American experience. The American ethos, the American mindset, is one that values above almost all things innovation, something new, progress. Sometimes for progress's sake, and when I talk about progress, I mean progress in every respect. We expect to have the newest, the best, and to be on the cutting edge of everything. And I think this is held true. If you go back and read the writings of observers of early American life, it is amazing. I'm thinking in particular about that work, Democracy in America, by Alexis de Tocqueville. He writes about America almost, well, yes, not almost, 200 years ago. But for all the world, it sounds as though he's talking about America today. There is a cultural mindset in America. It is undoubtable. You observe it everywhere you go. We are a culture of the new, of the latest, of the biggest, of the best. We generally tend to take all the things, all the measures by which we measure success in our culture and apply it to every aspect of our lives. We talk about the American dream, sometimes undefined. The American dream becomes one of those things you can just fill in the blank. Our celebrities, we extol them for living the American dream, from rags to riches. Our politicians, exactly the same way. I mean, how often have you heard a politician tell you his story? Even though, strangely enough, most of our politicians nationally nowadays are not rags to riches stories. The last big one was President Bill Clinton, a genuine rags to riches, obscurity to fame, Arkansas to Washington story. Whatever you thought of his politics, we love it. We love the story of the thing that started small and insignificant and meant nothing and was going nowhere and grows into something huge. We love it. We love it because it resonates with the dream that is built into Americans. But in a culture that values things like innovation, the latest, the biggest, the best, there is a danger. And I would say, unfortunately, that danger has become a part of the American dream, the American culture, the American ethos, the way we think about how life ought to be. That danger is the fad, the fashion. It is so much a part of our daily lives, we don't even think about it anymore. What's going to start this week, tonight? You might have even been looking for it for several months. All of the premieres, all of the new sitcoms. And while some of us are looking forward to our favorites coming back, what are we looking for? We want to know what's going to be different about this season. The Emmys, last night, strategically timed to coincide with the opening of the new television season. So many of us will be warming up next to the television tonight, seeing the newest show. We want to know what's there. We are drawn like moths to a flame. A dangerous prospect for the moth, by the way, to things that are new and different and unheard of. Has the church become a fad-driven church? One might argue one of the biggest fads to sweep the church in the last 50 years was the word faith movement. There are many people who don't know what that is. They'd say, I don't know what the word faith movement is. But when it's described to them, they say, okay, now I know what you're talking about. The teachers' names are well known. Benny Hinn and Kenneth Hagin and Kenneth Copeland. And then there are a few that kind of hang around outside at the edge of the door, like Pat Robertson or Joyce Meyer. The names are well known. You say, oh, they're word faith teachers? Yes. You use a term like name it and claim it, or a prosperity gospel, and then people's eyes start to show some glimmer of recognition. A new move of God, we're told. God's latest thing, his biggest, his best, the cutting edge of Christianity, we're told. Kenneth Hagin, by the way, the grandfather of the Word Faith movement, is lying in a hospital in critical condition. Now he's 86 years old, and there are a lot of 86-year-old people who lie in hospitals in critical condition, although Kenneth Hagin shouldn't be if his teachings are what he has claimed them to be for more than 50 years. I mean, sooner or later, the fad fades. One wonders whether Kenneth Hagin's movement, the Word Faith movement, will survive him long. It survived other Word Faith teachers, but he is the granddaddy. Jim Baker, he's got a new show. Not many affiliates, but he's got a new show. They film every weekday afternoon at 1 o'clock in the most appropriate of all places for Jim Baker to film a show, Branson, Missouri. He's back. He's been in prison. He was only in prison for a while. He was let out for good behavior. Sentenced to, what, 45 years? He served only 5? Some people thought obscurity is now his future. Remember when he was the brightest light, the biggest, the best, the greatest? He and Tammy Faye sitting there and raking in money until it was discovered that what they were doing was illegal. By the way, the 165 people who filed a class action lawsuit against Jim Baker, remember when he was planning his Heritage USA resort and he promised people 4-day vacation packages? Lots of people sent in money. They didn't get what they were promised. They received their settlement, by the way. Let's see. 165,000 people in the lawsuit. Each one of them will get $6.45. Now, part of that is because lawyers are taking the lion's share of the money. But even if lawyers hadn't taken a penny of the money, each one of them would have only received $22.42. And after being out of prison, he's back with a new Jim Baker show, filming down there in Branson. Maybe he can make the American dream a reality one more time. We all love the story, don't we? Maybe we even love that story more than we love the rags to riches. Have you ever seen the show on VH1, Behind the Music? It's become a cliche how all of these rock stars follow the same roller coaster in their life. All of these movie stars follow the same roller coaster in their life. They start as nothing. They rise meteorically, although meteors don't rise. They rise to fame. They fall meteorically. Then they rise again. They're up. They're down. We love the story. The latest fad to sweep the church is the 40-day fad of the purpose-driven life. Why can I say it's a fad? Well, because it's appealing to American Christendom for all the same reasons that all the other fads have appealed. This is from the pen of Rick Warren. He's the pastor of Saddleback Church out in Lake Forest, California. Started in his condo with just him and his real estate agent's family. That was back in 1980. 23 years later, he has one of the largest churches in the United States. 120-acre campus. Tens of thousands of members. A $19 million budget annually and a payroll that includes 330 people. Now, to Rick Warren's credit, he's been writing these books, The Purpose-Driven Church, The Purpose-Driven Life, and they've been selling like hotcakes, both of them New York Times bestsellers. One of them, The Purpose-Driven Life, voted Book of the Year. Apparently, all the profits he's made from Purpose-Driven Life have been put right back into Saddleback. In fact, he claimed recently, and there's no reason not to believe him, that he repaid his 21-year salary to Saddleback from the royalties of his book. They've been paying him all this time. He's repaid it. By all accounts, Rick Warren is an ordinary guy. Your average Joe. But he is also the guy with the biggest and the brightest and the latest idea. We're going to be doing a program a little later on, Issues, Etc., with a roundtable of pastors on The Purpose-Driven Life, doing a more in-depth evaluation. What struck me about, well, there's an LA Times on, it's called The How-To Kit for Ministry. From his Lake Forest megachurch, Rick Warren offers seminars, stats, and items on the internet to help pastors boost attendance. What struck me about this long feature on Rick Warren and The Purpose-Driven Life is how this latest movement, this latest fad, is being described. One of the attendees at Warren's seminar, where he gathered 250,000 pastors in the last decade, one of the attendees said this: "This is like being alive in the day of Martin Luther and being able to see him. This is the new Reformation." And Warren also speaks in similar terms about the movement. He says, quote, "The first Reformation clarified what the church believes, our message and our doctrine. The current Reformation," and I think he probably must be speaking about 40 Days of Purpose, "will clarify what the church does, our purpose and activities on earth." By the way, you got to be careful how you use that term, purpose-driven, because Warren has trademarked the term. I don't know how you indicate trademarks or copyrights when you're talking about it on the radio. But maybe you've heard of 40 Days of Purpose. 40 days in which Christian congregations are encouraged to read Rick Warren's book, The Purpose-Driven Life, one chapter at a time, one chapter a day. At the end, he promises, your life will be changed. Now, this has really caught on. It hasn't just, apparently, his thinking hasn't just done wonders for Saddleback. He calls the five purposes of the purpose-driven life the Intel chip of the 21st century church. You know what the Intel chip is in your computer, isn't it? It's the central processing unit. It's the brain of the thing. It's where all the thinking goes on. He says that the purpose-driven life is the Intel chip of the 21st century church. 30,000 churches in America now describe themselves as purpose-driven. I'm just wondering this in advance of the more formal conversation we'll have sometime from now on Issues, Etc., about the purpose-driven life. I told my producer, we've got to talk about this soon because, like all fads, it will fade. And by the time it fades, it won't be worth talking about anymore. A year from now, 2 years from now, maybe three, the churches that are flying the banners purpose-driven, where will those banners be? And I can hear some saying, look, but this is the way it ought to be. This is how these movements in the church ought to be. They come at just the right time. We use them and utilize them for as often as they're useful to us. And of course, we don't expect the purpose-driven life to stick around for the rest of the time. Which is kind of odd, because if you're going to compare it to the Reformation, if you're going to call it the Second Reformation, one could hardly argue that the Reformation was a fad. I mean, even the critics of the Reformation wouldn't call it a fad. They might call it the biggest disaster in the life of the church, but they wouldn't call it a fad. Fads, by definition, fade away. They're blown away by the next fad. They're rendered obsolete with the next biggest, best, cutting-edge movement. But I just ask this, how can the church continue in a, if it's going to be a church of purpose, if it's going to be a healthy church, if it's going to be a church, how can American Christendom continue to be anything but fad-driven when every time something like this comes along, everyone jumps on the bandwagon until the axles are about ready to break? And as soon as it's gone a little way down the road, we get a little tired of it, and we roll up the banners and we put them away, and the books all get put back into the church library or start gathering dust at home, and we move on to the next thing. A church that constantly hitches its wagon to these wandering stars. Some of them, look, we'll leave the evaluation for 40 Days of Purpose for a later conversation. There may be some good things here. I'm concerned about the bigger picture, about a church that says, about American Christendom that says, almost as though it suffers from perpetual amnesia, ah, here it is. Here is what is going to change everything. Purpose-driven seems to be changing things, at least in the congregations that are reporting back. 21% attendance increase, 79% increase in giving. Scott Thuma, by the way, he's a scholar at the Hartford Institute for Religious Research in Connecticut. They basically are the think tank for the church growth movement. He's a little wary. He says many programs promoted by consultants give churches initial bursts of growth that last 6 months to a year, but over the long term, attendance often declines. Everyone gets excited and says, this is wonderful, which is what people are saying about purpose-driven right now. But when attendance starts to dwindle again, the church members feel like we've failed. It leaves the church worse off than before, which is the way spirits that blow in and blow out tend to do. Another person wary of purpose-driven says this, and this is Philip Kennison, associate professor of theology and philosophy at Milligan College in Tennessee and co-author of the book Selling Out the Church, The Dangers of Church Marketing. He says, at best, I suspect that the purpose-driven church could be the hub for genuine discipleship and Christian formation. At worst, I fear that it may simply offer the latest venue for American consumers to forge an identity only where it comes through purchasing certain religious goods and services. Just think back, if you've had a number of years in the church, think back over the number of fads that have come and gone, how excited you were about some of them, how weary you were of others. None of them up to this point really claim to be the Second Reformation, but that's what Rick Warren is claiming of his, a Second Reformation. Better yet, if you can remember some of those fads, if you don't suffer from the perpetual amnesia, feel free to give me a call. They sweep in and sweep out so quickly that one could hardly, I mean, they happen on denominational levels. They happen sometimes, like purpose-driven, across denominational lines. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines. Are you concerned as I am, leaving aside the particulars of 40 Days of Purpose or the Purpose-Driven Church or Rick Warren or Saddleback, are you concerned as I am that the church seems to be addicted to fads? We seem to live on it like someone who lives on junk food. You know how they say with Chinese food, eat Chinese food and a half hour later you're hungry again? The church has been feeding on the Chinese food of the latest fad for the last 30 years, more. And everyone leaves the church hungrier than it was before for the next thing. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines, issues, etc. What do you make of Rick Warren's claim that the purpose-driven life is the second Reformation. The first one clarified what the church teaches and believes. This second one will clarify what the church does and practices. Will that claim hold up if all the purpose-driven banners and books are all gathering dust in storage rooms 5 years from now? 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. The New York Times reports that Kate Michelman is stepping down 18 years as the leader of what is now known as NARAL Pro-Choice America. She's probably, if there is a fixture in the pro-choice movement in the United States, she is it. She is the grand dame of the pro-choice movement in America. 18 years, she says, well, she's 61. She says she needs to care for her ailing husband and for her daughter. She's stepping down April 30th, 2004. No word of who will take her place. Kate Michelman, like many of the leaders in the pro-choice movement in the United States, has had an abortion herself. She uses the story of her abortion to argue for the wisdom of Roe. She says it was a difficult decision to make, but she had to do it. And when she started trying to get permission from her estranged husband to have the abortion, she found out that maybe her only alternative would have been to have an illegal abortion. Her abortion was in 1970. 4 years later, 3 years later, Roe v. Wade was passed, and since that time she's been working locally and then for the last 18 years nationally with NARAL to see to it that it remains law. Her warning to the pro-choice movement is that Americans have become complacent in the belief that this right granted by Roe will never be taken away, and they are wrong, she says. Women today face as grave a threat as ever to their constitutional rights to privacy and to choice. And in that, she's consistent. Ever since Roe has been passed, they've been telling us that it's going to be overturned. That was 30 years ago. When we come back, more open lines for your questions and your comments. Give me a call at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Are you concerned about fads in the church, or are you one of those who just have seen so many of them you can't get enough of them? Like going out to the latest movie that's opening up, or like sitting down tonight to the latest premiere of the latest sitcom, you're anxious for the next fad to sweep the church. We'll be right back with Open Lines. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.